Accession number 21029, Reel 1.
Freddie Watts, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born in West London in 1920.
Did both your mother and father come from London?
Yes. Yes, they were both born in London.
What did your father do for a living?
My father went to the First World War for 4 years, where he spent the whole time in the trenches, and when he came back he had to take what was going, and he for many years was a London bus driver with a little bit of professional football in between with Queen's Park Rangers, and he finished up as the deputy chief instructor at the Chiswick London Transport Driving School. That was him. In those days no women worked, so my mother stayed at home and brought up three children, of which I was the eldest.
Did you go to school in West London?
I did. I went to an ordinary council school, passed the scholarship, or later to be the 11 plus, and got on to a grammar school, but due to family circumstances I was forced to leave it before I was 15 to help with the family exchequer.
What kind of job did you get?
I went, by this time in 1933, when I was 13, we moved out to Southall in Middlesex, and I went into the biggest firm there, which was the Associated Equipment Company, AEC, who were commercial vehicle manufacturers, and they built all London's buses. And after 12 months in this and that, I was placed in the laboratory where I was allegedly going to be a metallurgist and chemist, and I carried on with further education, of course, and was doing that when the war broke out.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Oh, indeed, yes.
Under what circumstances?
With a bit of a hangover after a dance. I'd been out on a Saturday night dance the night before, and I was just recovering in our sitting room at home at Southall, and I heard the lot in my dressing gown.
How did you feel about the news?
Well, it was coming, wasn't it? Those of us who were of that age, I was 19, could see it coming. I think most of the people, our elders, were people who didn't want it to come, had experienced the First World War, and felt absolutely in horror about the whole thing. I was a bloodthirsty little ruffian, like a lot of my contemporaries. We didn't want it either, because we'd had some quite lotus-eating days. And it was an interruption. But there it was. It happened.
Did the war affect you at first?
Well, I went up immediately to try to join an infantry regiment. I had no aspirations to be doing anything else. I went to the recruiting office at Ealing and was told to go back to my firm. It was later I discovered that the only way to keep out of a reserved occupation was to volunteer for aircrew duties in either the Royal Navy or the Royal Air Force, which I duly did. So it didn't affect me all that much, really.
Were you in any bombing of London by the German Air Force?
Yes. not that seriously, because, as I say, we were out in Southall, but we did have a landmine in our road, which blew out a lot of windows and did quite a bit of damage to the house, but didn't stop evacuation.
What was your address at that time?
My address was... What, do you want the full address?
Please.
32 Ascot Gardens, Southall, Middlesex.
Were you at all frightened by the bombing?
Not particularly, no. I don't say this in any sense of boastfulness, but at 19 or 20, as I then was, you are indestructible, really. Nothing's going to hurt you.
Do you remember any other bombs that fell in Southall area?
Not to any extent at all, no, no.
Can you tell me about the process of joining the RAF, please?
Yes, I had to register for conscription, even though I was told I was in a reserved occupation. So when I went up, I opted for aircrew. I thought I could probably become quite a useful wireless operator or air gun or something like that. And when the time came, I didn't have to go up for any more than a nominal passover by the army. And then I had to wait a little before I went up to, I think it was the Dastrell House, for the Air Force selection. I went up there, and they told me that I'd done fairly well in their tests, and why did I want to become a wireless operator air gunner? And I said, well, I think I can take the training. I don't think I'm up to anything more than that. We didn't sell ourselves all that well in those days. And the rather elderly Air Commodore, who was chairman of the board, said, well, let us be the judge of that lad. We consider you might be suitable for training as a pilot or an observer or a navigator. So I went away and went on deferred service and was waiting for the postman to bring my call-up papers. In the fullness of time, I received my service number, which was some sort of progress, and later I was called up to join the colours.
What was the next step?
The next step was into a reception at Regent's Park. Anyway, in the vicinity of the zoo, which was rather apposite, I feel, the way we were treated there. And after being kitted up and jabbed with needles, I was sent off to what they call a selected station. This was not a mass-produced ground subject school with about 1,000 or so various intakes of aircrew. This was a selected station based on an operational training unit, which at the time was an OTU for Hampden aircraft, and we were separate from the rest of them. We had our own little school where we took navigation, armament, aircraft recognition, signals, and we also did an awful lot of exercise. We were very fit young men. That was the first stage. We passed out as from AC-2 UT air crew to LAC's pilots under training. We then went on to 21 Flying Training School, Booker, near High Wycombe, and we were graded on Tiger Moths, and that was the end of my service in this country, up to not being a pilot in the Air Force. I then went on to a troop ship and went over to the United States, where I became part of the Arnold training scheme.
Anything that happened on the troop ship journey to America?
Yes, 17 days of misery. Being in the W's, and the Air Force, or all the services, do things by alphabet. I was in the W's, and I found instead of being on the Queen Elizabeth or Queen Mary, I was on a very, very old ship. And we did have to, there was a convoy, and we did have to do a lot of zigzagging because submarines had been sounded on track. Fortunately, I had a good stomach for these sort of things. Very severe North Atlantic gales, but I didn't miss a meal. So, yes, it was a fairly eventful journey for 17 days on a 17,000-ton ship. And we got into Halifax, Nova Scotia, reasonably unscathed, but we were all lousy because we couldn't bath or shower.
You mean you had lice?
Hmm. Yes, not badly, but we soon deloused ourselves.
What happened to you once you got to Halifax?
Hmm?
What happened to you once you got to Halifax?
Well, we stayed there and got re-kitted out. We stayed there for 3 weeks, and I think we ate our heads off because we'd all been mashed and what have you. And then we were put on the train, and we went down to the Deep South. We went through Pennsylvania Station, and we actually went through Chattanooga, which was, you know, later famous with Glenn Miller and what have you. And we finished up in Georgia, where we were taken in to the welcoming arms of the United States Army Air Corps, as it then was. And we came under American discipline, and we rubbed shoulders with American cadets who had finished, had done 4 years, or done 3 years at West Point, and were doing their fourth year, so they could be not only West Point qualified officers, but pilots as well. So we came under very strict American discipline.
In what way was it so strict?
Well, they had the honor system there, where, whereas in the services here, if you can get away with it, you do. But if you got away with anything, you were expected to report yourself on your honor. A certain misdemeanor you'd carried out. We found this rather hard to swallow.
So did you just ignore it?
Well, no, we played along with it when we had to. They were very, very fair, but they were very, what shall I say, they were almost Teutonic in their outlook on life, and it was one man against the other. I mean, if you got onto a station where the people who were there a fortnight before you or a month before you were the upperclassmen, then they were the people who could haze you. You were expected to show great respect to them, whereas back home, if you went on a new station on a course, you'd grab the next chap on the more senior course and say, "What's it like here, mate?" And they would tell you. So it took a bit of getting used to, but their discipline was most strict, and they in America, and you could get turned down off the flying course for little misdemeanors which had bore no relationship to flying at all.
Did you get punished there yourself?
No, I didn't actually. I managed to keep out of it. I'd come a long way and I was going to go along with the system. I wasn't going to be sent home as the chap who didn't get through the pilot's course. And there were a lot of people sent back, not only for disip reasons, but also, of course, when the flying started, and their flying training was excellent. They were very, very precise in what one counted as a pass and what counted as a fail. A lot of people got sent back to Canada before they'd been down there very long at all. There were a lot of washouts in the American scheme or in the Arnold scheme, and I think most people one talks to agrees on this. They all felt that they'd cleared a major hurdle when they really got through the training scheme, let alone the war.
What type of aircraft were you flying in?
We started off on basic trainers, which were, well, primary trainers they're called, Stearman PT-17 biplanes, a little bigger than our Tiger Moth. We did about 60 hours there, and then we were shifted on to another station, still in Georgia, and we went on to rather larger faulty BT-13As. They were big radial engine aircraft. Well, they seemed big to us at the time. And there was another 70 hours there. And having done the second hurdle, then we were interviewed and given some sort of choice. Everybody wanted to fly Spitfires. I didn't. I always wanted to go on to bombers. So I didn't have any problem there, because on the third and advanced training, a lot of disappointed single-engine people went on to twin engines, but I went on to twin engines too, which is what I wanted, and they were Beechcraft AT-10s, a nice twin-engine aircraft. I think some of them even fly today.
What had made you want bombers rather than fighters?
I think I wanted... This sounds a little bellicose, but I think I wanted to go and bomb Germany, to put it... I was brainwashed as a child into not liking the Germans, and then what they did in the early, very early part of the war, I didn't like very much. And I don't know how this comes out, but I felt I would be a good bomber pilot and could run a crew. And that is why I asked for bombers.
Any incidents that happened to you whilst you were in America?
Not particularly, no, no. Nothing very much could happen, because one was never off limits to any great extent. So there were no sort of adventures that one could look back on particularly. We were under fairly hard discipline.
Did you do any socialising with the Americans?
Well, I didn't. This is a personal opinion. I am very fond of the Americans, but they seem to make a hobby of entertaining the British and then asking what they thought of their hospitality. And I didn't like that very much. They weren't really in the war seriously, and they just didn't know what was going off. I've had Americans ask me why we didn't build Spitfires and why we didn't build the Queen Mary. Faced with that sort of limited intelligence, I wasn't much in those days for Anglo-American relations. I changed later on when it came to the real stuff, but no, not in those days.
And then?
Well, I came out reasonably well on my course, and I was asked whether I would consider taking a commission. I wasn't offered one. I was a man came down from Washington, a wing commander, a liaison chap came down from a Royal Air Force man from Washington, and we were asked this question, and I said, well, I by this time had thought I was capable of holding down a commission, and I did say this. He said, well, of course, it would mean you staying in the United States as an instructor to form the nucleus of the rest of the British courses that were coming over. And they did have a leavening of British instructors over there already. And I said, no, I didn't join the Royal Air Force for a lotus-eating existence. He said, well, it means you go back as sergeant pilot. So I said, well, that's it. And he mentioned to me, he said, I see you've put down for bombers. He said, I'm sure that as long as you survive, a commission will come along. He was, of course, I think, talking of dead men's shoes. But that's what happened. And I came home to answer your question originally, as a sergeant pilot.
What was the journey back like?
Well, that was, again, I was still in the W's, and I came back on quite a reasonable old ship, but it was a similar 20,000 tonner. And it took us 13 days, which was long enough, you know, the 17 going, 13 coming back, and we had to divert because, again, submarines had been sounded off the northwest of Ireland. So instead of going into Gourock and having to train down from Scotland, it suited us to come herring in the troop ship down through the Irish Sea, and we went into Bristol. Avonmouth, and then we were given a fortnight's leave, and that was the end of that.
And then?
Posted to an advanced flying unit, which was really intended to to teach us the ropes of flying in this country, because after all, the whole country was blacked out. Night flying, as such in America, was almost as good as day flying, because there were cities lit up and what have you. So an advanced AFU, an advanced flying unit, and we were flying only Oxfords, airspeed Oxfords, nice, polite little aircraft, was to show us various bits and pieces about how to fly the beacons and how to recognise this and that. That was just... Oh, and it's... We did a beam approach training flight when we were there, how to fly this rather... Well, it was fairly early stuff, the beam approach, but they gave us that. And that was at Shawbury in Shropshire.
And then?
I was posted on to number 14 operational training unit at Cottesmore in Rutlandshire, and where we were picked up the nucleus of our crews, and we trained on Wellington 1Cs, rather old Wellingtons, with derated Pegasus engines, if I remember rightly. And that is where I met up. Bunches of pilots were posted in, so many pilots, so many navigators, wireless operators, and one air gunner and a bomb aimer. And we amalgamated, we sorted each other out, and we formed a crew of five people to do about 60 or 70 hours of operational training in Wellingtons. And that's when we were, although they were old, that was the first time I found myself in charge of a real bomber.
What did you think of flying the Wellington?
Well, I was very impressed. They were a wonderful old aircraft. They were slow, they were heavy, but they were very sturdy. And of course, I was still filled with wonderment at taking one of these largest aircraft into the sky at night and getting it back down on again. I quite enjoyed my operational training unit.
What do you remember next? What do you remember next?
Next was on to a heavy conversion unit for conversion onto Lancasters. That was at Royal Air Force Wigsley, which was a little way out of Lincoln, between almost equidistant between Lincoln and Gainsborough. And that was a sea of mud, very much an uncomfortable station with Nissen huts and seas of mud. And I remember particularly two messes. They had a sergeant's mess for the permanent staff and a separate mess for the courses going through. And of course, the latter ones were very, very ill-equipped, and they didn't have the steady, standard, feet under the table approach that the permanent staff messes had. But that was all right. By this time, it's an important point, at OT, heavy conversion, that's where we picked up the rest of our crew. Of course, we needed a flight engineer on a four-engine aircraft, and another gunner, Oh, that was about it. We picked up the other two, that's right. Seven in the crew, including myself. So I had a flight engineer and a mid-upper gunner, and there were seven of us. And when we passed out of heavy conversion unit, I'd already been recommended for a commission, but I was then a flight sergeant when I was posted next on to my squadron.
Can you give any details of your crew? Do you if you remember their names and where they come from?